From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center now presents the final segment in its series on politics and the American character, a general examination of social and political ideas inherited from antiquity and passed by the American founders into the present. The speakers are Marvin Myers of Brandeis University and Edward Erler of California State College at San Bernardino, both of whom are scholars at the National Humanities Center. Alvin Bernstein of Cornell University and John Agresto, my colleague at the National Humanities Center.
I think if you were looking for very precise borrowings, you wouldn't find a great deal. There was no notion of imitating ancient forms, and indeed I think there was only a modest effort to study the ancient thought in its own terms. I think what they borrowed was a very broad sense of a people capable of its own governance and a society whose members could explore out to the limits of the human intellect. And I suppose it would be most sharply expressed if one contrasted it with their view of tyrannical and despotic and slavish societies. They defined slavery as a problem, as a profound problem for human society and for American society. It is rare that you will find among the founders any language that admits slavery as a legitimate way of relating human beings to one another. All you will find is a concession to what for most of them would be a tragic historical inheritance that is enormously difficult to get out from under, with hopes that in various gradual ways, the society will discover the ways of moving toward the end of slavery. And at one point or another, I think one has to say, they didn't press their principles to the point where they denied themselves the fruits of the labor of slaves.
In some ways, the interesting thing about the founders is not really that they had slaves, but that they signed a document and wrote a document that condemned their own holding of slaves, and in fact signed a document that led to the very abolition on the same principles that they held, the abolition of the slavery that was in their society.
I agree with John. After all, without the principles, such principles as those enunciated in the Declaration of Independence, how can you possibly say that slavery is wrong? Without an argument for the equality of all human beings, it's impossible to say that slavery, which after all is one of the oldest institutions in the world, is somehow wrong or unjust. After all, slavery is the way of the world. And without some kind of principled argument for the equality of men and the natural rights of men, there's no way that you can say that slavery is wrong. Commercialism, yes. America was designed to be a commercial republic, but the commercialism was selected in order to produce political liberty. As we've mentioned before, commercialism doesn't produce a heroic people. It doesn't produce a spectacular people. But as Bud Myers has said eloquently on several occasions, it raises up the great mass of society and brings them up to a condition of material comfort and a condition of political liberty. And from a certain perspective, this may look to be somewhat vulgar. But I think from the perspective of 1787, where the bulk of mankind was living under the worst tyrant of all, that is to say, under the grinding heel of poverty, this material comfort, which in the end leads to the production of political liberty, is not so vulgar. It wouldn't perhaps make for a spectacular society, but it would make for a peaceful society, it would make for a stable society, and it would make for a long-lasting society. The reason that commercialism was intended to be a part of the American character was simply that we wouldn't do things precipitously. I mean, the way in which, let us say, Montesquieu and even the founding fathers spoke about commercialism as a way of life which would soften men's manners. It would sort of blunt all of the rough edges of human nature. We would be slow to become angry. We would be slow to take up arms and things of this character. It would be a great moderating force in society. And I think that we see this. After all, America is said to be always the last one to take up arms and the first one to lay them down. And I think that there's something true about that.
How can you say that if commercialism fosters competitiveness? How does it take the edge off of the
military? Let me answer that if I can, because in a sense you're right, of course. It's not only fosters competitiveness, but it's built on an understanding of competitiveness. But that's not the only result of commercialism. That I think Ed's absolutely right, that it certainly softens, as he puts it, softens the harsh edges of human nature. It also teaches, despite the fact that it begins with a kind of selfish competitiveness, it ends up by teaching a kind of community and even a kind of neighborliness. Because in fact, if you're, let's say, a car dealer whose only ambition is to gouge the public, you won't be in business very long. If you're in fact the person who wishes to cheat his clients, you may get away with it for a while, but not for too long. To be a good businessman, in a sense, you have to have certain virtues.
Forces you to honesty.
That's exactly where I'm coming from. Forces you to honesty. Now, you didn't begin with the idea that you wanted to go help your fellow men, perhaps, but you wind up with the notion that the way to get ahead in this world is a kind of being a part of a civic body where you have fellow citizens, neighbors, and friends, even at the best level.
Okay. Something that John just said reminded me of a way that you could show the difference between ancient and modern virtue. John mentioned that a car dealer would have to be honest in order to stay in business. That reminds me of the old phrase that honesty is the best policy. That is to say, if you're honest, that's the best way to make money. Whereas in the ancient world, you would say that honesty was valuable in and of itself. That is to say, because it's good to be an honest person. But here you see a character trait which is not seen as something valuable in and of itself, but instrumental to another end. That is to say, honesty is the best policy. We're not honest people because we think it's good to be honest people, but it's good for business.
But you know, it's funny, even though we say that, very often we say that only as a phrase. We really mean we want to be honest.
Well, that's true, but if you take honesty as the best policy, you're more likely to have more honest people under those circumstances than if you said that honesty is something which is valuable in and of itself.
And its own reward.
Exactly.
Well, the first thing I think is that what John was saying is not unique to commercial societies, and it's certainly not unique to American society. It's the demands of society that you're describing. I mean, and in no way sets us apart. I mean, you might make the case, it's a case I'd be uncomfortable making, but it would be a defensible case, that all these notions have their origins in utility anyway. That the origin of moral notion is what society demands for its cohesiveness. And so it's not just a commercial society that ought not to cheat. It's an agrarian society ought not to have the dishonest people amongst it. I think the second thing is that I think that certainly the Romans were as utilitarian about their virtues, at least early on, as we're being described. The notion of something being intrinsically good seems to me to be a Greek philosophical notion. I'm not really sure it ever caught on in the ancient world. It's certainly Platonic, but if you look at the concepts of Roman morality, they're very instrumental. To give a graphic example, there's a moment when the Romans are trying to deal with the Spaniards, who are very difficult to deal with. They're difficult to deal with because they'll make a promise and the next day they'll break the promise. And there's one stage there where Scipio Aemilianus himself is dealing with a particular city, and he's trying to deal with two cities simultaneously. So in the one case, he finds the 400 people who are advocating an anti-Roman policy, marches to the city that day, demands that they be turned over to him, cuts off their hands, and then goes back to what he was doing beforehand. That's a kind of the interesting thing about that is after it's all over, he starves the other city into surrender, and he enslaves it, and he brings back the entire population, at least those who haven't been starved to death. And when he arrives in Rome, they vote him a triumph. For this conduct, for this behavior, they give him, they bestow upon him, you know, the greatest military honor that they can. That seems to me to be a very instrumental attitude towards, you know, what I mean, towards what virtue requires the military.
Looking around at students that I teach, students that I've taught, the question they always ask, or what they're looking for, is, or the complaints they have in class sometimes are, let's not just look, be so ethnocentric. Let's not look at just American history, Western civilization. Let's look at the Eastern moralities and Eastern religions. Let's look at things as foreign to us as we can. One thing about the classics, something about antiquity, is that it could fill a gap there. Partly because it is foreign, and partly because it's not foreign. And the important thing about teaching or studying the classics is that it's something that is in some ways natively ours. We built the civilization on those ruins. But it's a society different from ours as well. We have a kind of attachment to them, but a kind of distance from them that gives us the ability to see ourselves differently and newly. And at the same time, not to go to look at things totally alien to the lives of students, or the culture itself.
The thing about the ancients is that they reflected a lot in various subtle ways about their own institutions. And for reasons which I can't really describe, there was an extraordinary concentration of absolutely astonishing minds who engaged in this reflection.
A direct parallel to that, Al, I think, is to think of the extraordinary concentration of talents that turned up at the American founding. Out of the scattered society with a modest provincial colonial past, in a period of a very few years, it managed to summon from within itself a kind of talent that didn't express itself in the masterworks that form the great books of Western civilization, but rather in serious, searching, practical reflections on how to translate broad ideals into working institutions with some chance of surviving in a hard, cruel world, and some chance of surviving the flaws in human nature itself, which they never thought could be eradicated in some way as to promise perfection on earth. And so I think the interest in studying our founders is not simply to say, where did it begin? And even to look at their formal teachings, but to see it as these extraordinary men in this extraordinary time coming to grips with a fundamental turn in history and illuminating it by their works and by their lives as well. I think it's clear that Americans did have a sense of destiny, a sense of a purpose that was both internal, that is, that was to provide a nation that would endure, and the Constitution was dedicated to a more perfect union toward securing the blessings of liberty for our posterity. Certainly all the language of the Declaration, if one goes back to that, the pledge of our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor is hardly something you make for today or even for just tomorrow. That is, there was a sense of a long life to be achieved if men had the wit, the courage, and the perseverance to make it happen. And beyond that, a sense of destiny in the wide world. If one looks to the language either of the Revolution or beyond it, this was a nation that was to be a model. If not literally so, if not to copy and imitate every bit and piece of American institutions, laws, even in detail principles, certainly to provide a model for freedom. They had a sense that republicanism, self-government on the principle of liberty, really was at stake, and that the success or failure of their society would have a great deal to do with the success or failure of freedom and self-government in the world at large. Now, this can be reduced to, I think, and has been by some, to a kind of silly grandiosity. We have it in our hands to make the whole world over in some direct, literal way, a kind of illusion of omnicompetence and so on. I think it was not so silly. It was a sense that the world needed important examples of a society that could indeed embody those principles and put them to work in such a way as to provide a free and a good life for its citizens, and thereby to provide an example that others might turn to. So that in that sense, freedom, this very diversity and plurality of life, was to be that which gave a continuing identity to their society, and which was to have a destiny in the world in that it would provide an example to which other men could turn in the general expectation, or at least high hope, that other men would be seeking an example of freedom and self-government, that it lay deep in human nature and in the nature of things that human beings would not tolerate a slavish or merely dependent life.
Alvin Bernstein teaches classics at Cornell University. Marvin Myers and Edward Erler are scholars at the National Humanities Center. John Agresto is on the staff of the center. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the final segment of the Center's series on politics and the American character, which concludes now with a conversation with the editor of the Norfolk Virginian Pilot. Terry Eastland recently visited the Center's seminar on citizenship, where he discussed the interplay of religion, politics, and citizenship at the time of America's beginnings and in the present.
I think they envisioned a citizenry in which the individuals had a certain degree of virtue. It's an old-fashioned word, but by that I think they meant such civic virtues as honesty regarding the well-being of another person first, keeping in mind the common good, being honest in our relationships with others. These, again, are civic virtues, and these are not heroic virtues. They don't require feats of courage, let's say, but minimal virtues that should be within the reach of everyone. The problem that these men saw was this, and Madison, I think, best sketched it when he said that historically men have thought that religion needed government in order for religion to survive, and that government needed religion in order for government to survive. And to some degree, these men wished to get out of that bind. And they wish to say that, well, religion can survive on its own without being tied to government, and that government can survive on its own without an established church. All that being said, I think they did recognize that there was maybe a more subtle relationship between the virtues that religion could foster, and those virtues being necessary to the preservation of the form of government and the type of society that they constructed.
Terry, how would you trace some of the differences or the similarities between religion then and religion now? Religion at the time of the founding of the American polity and what we see about us now? Big question.
Wayne, well, it's a good question. Those who are sympathetic, as I am, to religion and its relationship to the American Republic must recognize that religion today in all of its manifestations is not what it was 200 years ago.
Is it? Is not as severe. It's not as doctrinal. It's not.
In many ways, you're right. What has happened? C.S. Lewis once had an apt description of that maybe tells us something about our time. He said that Jane Austen had more in common with Cicero than we have in common with Jane Austen. Today, we don't have the history of the Protestantism in this country. I think Sidney Ahlstrom in his large, mammoth, and very interesting book, which documents American church history, points out that we may be, by now, I think, at the end of what he calls the Puritan era. And it may be fair to say that the Puritan era began, you know, back in 1620, and it's been going on for many, many years. Probably started its slide or its end can be traced to certainly the earlier parts of this century.
Well, regardless of whether a citizen believes or disbelieves, is hostile to religion or indifferent, whatever, where is the citizen's first duty? How did the founders look at this notion of citizenship? Was it, for instance, to God? Was it to the citizen's society?
Well, let me take a run at it this way. I think that, you know, in Madison, in his memorial and remonstrance against a bill that would have assessed taxpayers in Virginia for paying the salaries of teachers of the Christian religion, Madison, right in the middle of this argument against that bill, happened to say that man and his in the nature that exists before man enters the civil society has duties toward God. So he recognizes that religion in a way is prior to and antecedes political society.
Is that what we've lost?
Well, I think there are a lot of people today who would like to have Madisonianism without having the recognition that these rights depend upon God to begin with, you see. I take Madison as an example, a better example maybe than Jefferson. I don't know if he's always to be trusted. There are sometimes some rhetorical flourishes in what he says, but he too talks about the conviction that our liberties depend upon the conviction in the hearts and minds of men that these liberties derive from and are dependent upon God. Now, let me just make this point here that that today I think that we have gotten to a large degree away from that. We don't like to admit that perhaps the American Republic, even the idea of church of separation of church and state, is grounded in a prior belief in God. To get to your question, though, I think that in terms of being a good citizen, it's a complicated question. But I think that the founders would say that a religious person should follow the beliefs of his conscience, but he cannot expect to get away with it if it's something that violates the laws of the state.
There are some ministers, there are many social critics, who say that the ills of American society are traceable to a lack of religion. What do you think?
I think that religion, rightly understood, if I may borrow from a founding father here, religion, rightly understood, could help this country. But let me stress that the definition of religion today is so broad as to include almost everything in the world. So when I say religion is a good thing for this country, it's necessary to ask what kind. I think those religions which still believe in God, which still believe in an objective moral law, which still say there is a right and a wrong and a true and a falsehood, I think that those religions have something to offer to the American Republic. But I think that those that are simply fancy names, if religion is a fancy name for the pursuit of anything, of individualism, narcissism, any hedonism, mm-hmm. That's something else again.
What do you attribute the change to? How did it happen? How did we get away from this notion of simple civic duty grounded in whatever kind of religious belief?
Well, I think for one reason, the inertia in the American Republic is always towards liberty. And I think liberty is a great political idea. It is not the greatest, certainly not in terms of its lineage, of its history.
But the other side of liberty, as you're describing it, is irresponsibility.
Well, there's a distinction.
And civic sloth.
There
is that right?
There can be one can make a distinction between liberty and license. Mm-hmm. And I think that liberty properly ordered, is a good thing. Liberty, which is a license to do anything, is quite a different proposition, and can lead to, I mean, Tocqueville and other people have written about the sorts of tyrannies that. A disordered and uncontrolled liberty can lead to.
Terry, let's bring this issue right up into the present. What about this debate that's going on now about tuition tax credits? It favors the churches. It favors these private schools. It even fosters segregation, racism. What about that?
Wayne, I think, first of all, that it's an enormously complicated question. But if we tease out the one angle that seems to bother those people who are worried about religion and politics, it is the question of separation of church and state. Does not this scheme tend to
bring them together?
Yeah. Well, my reaction to that is no. I think that the modern day interpretation of the Establishment Clause, which stems from a decision in 1947 up to the present, that interpretation has been largely flawed in my view. There's the historical evidence is starting to come forward. There's been a recent book published on this by a man named Robert Cord, who has articulated what he calls the historical fact and distinguished that from the fiction that the court has offered us. But I think basically what it boils down to is that the First Amendment, if considered in its historical context, would permit aid to parochial schools or private schools so long as it was not channeled simply to one type of parochial school. In other words, you can have aid to religion so long to schools that might teach religion so long as it does not discriminate in towards one church in favor of one church over another. The one question that is worth raising is not in terms of intention, mm-hmm. but in terms of effect. In other words, which of the church schools would benefit more? And one could maybe make an argument that that because maybe Catholic schools might be benefited more because there's plenty of them than, say, Presbyterians who don't have many of these schools at all. You know, it could be argued, well, because it benefits them, if because the effects are greater there, that it is an establishment. I still have trouble with that argument, again, simply because it would be there available for all to use. Because they don't choose to use it, so what? I would also argue that Presbyterians and many of your mainline Protestant churches, as I earlier said, have established schools in a way, mm-hmm. Established religious schools in a way, because the public school system, in many, many instances, came out of a framework where the most influential people were your Protestants running them.
And we've simply historically shed that knowledge.
That's right. In fact, I once suggested to some Presbyterian ministers that they start their own schools. Well, that's like telling someone that what they do is not a very good job and they start doing something else, because, in fact, Presbyterians have been running in Episcopalians. And I say this, by the way, as a Presbyterian, so I'm not saying this is someone who's standing apart from them. It's an enormously complicated question, and I think that anyone who looks into it, for example, I don't have any great problems with the question of the First Amendment on this, but I do have some practical questions. For example, I think in an age, in a year, when we're trying to balance the budget, or at least to find, it'll never be balanced, it seems to me, but in terms of finding more revenues, here the president's proposing, you know, $1 billion or $2 billion, whatever it'll cost. It seems to be unrealistic to be proposing it now. Secondly, for a president who has insisted that education is a responsibility of the states, it strikes me, you know, the question could be raised, why in the world does the federal government need to be doing this? Tuition tax credits could be something that that the states individually do, or a plan that I would support myself, a voucher plan, I think, in the states. After all, we are an experimental nation. Let some states experiment. Some have started to, in fact, in this. But let them give vouchers. The problem with the tuition tax credit, as it's set up, is that only if you're paying taxes could you take the credit. A voucher could go to everyone.
Terry Eastland is editor of the Norfolk Virginian Pilot. He was a recent visitor to the seminar on citizenship at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me this week for the fifth segment in the Center's series of conversations about politics and the American character. The discussion focuses on political liberty and ideas about commercialism inherited from antiquity by the American founders and passed into the present-day American enterprise. That's Politics and the American Character, Part 5, this week on Soundings.